Okay, we are back for episode 125. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Well, tonight we agreed to talk about, Holocaust victims. And, of course, we're not talking about the alleged 6 million who perished at the hands of the Third Reich. We are talking about those people who question the narrative, those people who are dissidents or revisionists who have been ostracized, and in some countries actually imprisoned, lost their jobs, so people who dare to voice their opinion on a historical matter, a controversial historical matter. Of course, laws against Holocaust denial, they call it, I guess when you go against the narrative, although the narrative is ever-changing, there's actually revisionists within the actual official narrative camp because they're constantly changing the narrative, how many, where, when. But anyway, Holocaust denial, the denial of the systematic genocidal killing of approximately 6 million Jews in Europe by Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 1940s is illegal in 16 European countries and Israel. Many countries have broader laws that criminalize genocide denial. Of the countries that ban Holocaust denial, some such as Austria, Germany, Hungary, and Romania were allegedly among the perpetrators of the Holocaust, and many of these also banned other elements associated with Nazism, such as expression of Nazi symbols. Laws against Holocaust denial have been proposed in many nations, in addition to those nations that have criminalized such acts, including the United States and United Kingdom. But such proposals for laws have received criticism and faced opposition, most significantly from civil rights and human rights advocates who contend that such laws would violate people's established rights of freedom of speech and freedom of expression. Scholars have pointed out that countries that specifically ban Holocaust denial generally have legal systems that limit speech in other ways, such as banning hate speech. According to D.D. Guttenplan, this is a split between the common law countries of the United States, Ireland, and many British Commonwealth countries, from the civil law countries of continental Europe and Scotland. In civil law countries, the law is generally more proscriptive. Also, under civil law regime, the judge acts more as an inquisitor, gathering and presenting evidence as well as interpreting it. Michael Wine argues that Holocaust denial can inspire violence against Jews. He states, Jews' experience in the post-World War II era suggests that their rights are best protected in open and tolerant democracies that actively prosecute all forms of racial and religious hatred. The argument that laws punishing Holocaust denial are incompatible with the European Convention on Human Rights and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights have been rejected by institutions on the of the Council of Europe, the European Court of Human Rights, and also by the United Nations Human Rights Committee. Historians have opposed such laws. Raoul Hilberg, who was a well-known Holocaust historian, has been critical of it. Of course, the late Christopher Hitchens, Peter Singer, and also Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky said, "It seems to me something of a scandal that is even necessary to debate those issues 2 centuries after Voltaire defended the right of free expression for views he detested. It's a poor service to the memory of victims of the Holocaust to adopt a central doctrine of their murderers." January 2019, Deborah Lipstadt, she's of course well known for her being sued by David Irving for libel. She expressed her opinion. She said, "I am still a firm opponent of laws against Holocaust denial. First of all, I'm a pretty fierce advocate of the First Amendment, having been sued for libel and having had that in my life for about 6 years, and more than ever. Even though libel is not covered by the First Amendment, David Irving wouldn't have been able to sue me in this country because he was a public figure." So, of course, in Germany, the laws is against Holocaust denial. I guess it's justified under the incitement of hatred and also the disparagement of memory of deceased persons. So if question the Holocaust narrative, you are disparaging the memory of the dead, and they can throw you in prison for that. Now, of course, it is a kind of odd as an American, most Americans, so many decades after this event, that somehow preaches, I guess, teaches us the unique, for monstrosity of the Germans, that we are forced to accept it. We can't criticize it. We're supposed to live in a free country. Those who question the narrative do not deny that they're suffering during the war, and many Jews suffered during the war and were murdered, died and were murdered at the hands of the Nazis. We're not disputing it, nor are we disputing that there were atrocities committed by the Third Reich during the war, as were by all the belligerents in that war. So we're not saying no one died and no one suffered. So we can get into some of the problems with the narrative and what really happened and how it's been since interpreted. Of course, some of the famous victims of Holocaust denial laws are Ernst Zundel, who was a German who had emigrated to Canada, then went through a series of we can get into some of the details of these cases, but he had a couple of legal battles in Canada, which he did lose. Then he did emigrate to the United States. Then the United States deported him to Germany, where he was, I think, served 7 or 8 years in solitary confinement for his criticism of the Holocaust narrative. There's also Robert Ferrisson in France. Of course, David Irving, who actually was charged almost 16, 17 years later for something he said in Austria in 1989. Then he was in Germany, was arrested in Germany. I think he was taken off a plane or something and served a few months in prison there. Of course, there's Gomar Rudolph, who's a German who... a chemist who did some testing at the alleged gas chambers at Auschwitz and published his results for that. He was hounded and arrested in Germany. He left Germany to Britain, and when Germany threatened to extradite him, he came to the United States, and then the United States didn't accept his petition as a political, asylum or something. Yeah, political asylum. And... he was subsequently deported to Germany, where he served several years in prison. He's now free, living in the United States. I think he married an American woman and has children now. They broke up as their first marriage. So a lot of these, we can get into some of the details of these stories, but basically these people are just simply expressing their opinion. You don't even have to get into whether you agree with them or not, but they're simply expressing their opinion on a historical matter, a controversial historical matter. We had a recent case down in Florida, which kind of got me thinking about this. Was we had a school principal down there who was asked about why his school didn't have a Holocaust curriculum or class. It was Dr. William Lotson. He was a principal in Spanish River Community High School in South Florida. He was recently fired. The reason, given some pretext for him not returning phone calls when he was on vacation or something, but really it started when he was asked by someone why there weren't classes. And his response was he responded that the Holocaust studies were all available for all students, but weren't mandatory. And he said that apparently he told the I think it was a mother that only a tiny minority had signed up for the classes, and it was a controversial subject, and it's a politically polarizing topic. The Jewish parent then responded by saying the Holocaust was not a right or a belief. It's a fact. And then that's when the ADL got involved, and apparently they've orchestrated or arranged for him to be fired. It's under appeal right now. But he wasn't even denying the Holocaust. He just said that it's a controversial topic, which it is, of course. But for that, he lost his job. And I guess his union is trying to defend him now. But that's what got me thinking about this. Again, we do in the United States have free speech, but then again, even in the United States, if you do voice a view which goes against the narrative, you may quickly find yourself unemployed and ostracized. So there is social pressure to conform to it because of the powers that be. So that's a quick overview of the topic. What do you have to say about these victims of the Holocaust?
Oh, wow. What a huge, huge topic. Very hard to drill down to, specific things. The first thing I would point out is that in general and historically, even though these people have been charged with Holocaust denial, that's actually not what they did. And it's really not what the laws are intended to prevent. What they were doing was Holocaust analysis. You know, that's really, if you look at like Fowerson or Irving, I mean, they're not, they will come to conclusions, but they will do so as the basis of analysis. They actually put out data, streams of logic, right? Interviews. They actually are the ones who have, that you were mentioned in general. They're trying to analyze the Holocaust. They're trying to come to some sort of understanding of its historical reality. And so what the laws are trying to do is to stop thought. And that's really what they are trying to do. They're not really to basically, you know, punish people for hatred. I mean, if you read like Irwin or Fowenson, if anything, they're overly analytic. If you know what I mean, they're not spewing emotion or hatred, and they're really they just have a very, very nuanced kind of process to that thinkers in general go through, Socratic type logic basically, and yet they are charged with a crime, and so I think the first thing is to like try to break apart the semantical domination, because we really don't want to describe these people as Holocaust deniers. I think that's their term, and it just isn't a correct one. It doesn't get people thinking about who these people are and why they are, you know, being attacked. They are Holocaust analyzers, and so that would be like the first thought that I would, you know, bring forward is let's like try to focus the conversation into whether or not analysis and thought are permitted, because that's really what these laws are trying to stop. And then when you presented this as a topic, you know, I sometimes people ask, like, you know, like the kind of like deep think tank that you and I must go into to create our conversations, you know. I mean, basically someone will just send like a 4-word email to the other person and that's that, you know, and then we show up and talk about it. But I thought about, you know, I thought, God, that's kind of an interesting topic. And the more I thought about it, Tim, the more it just was like one of those like brain stimulators, because I realized that there was just a another group of Holocaust victims that I did want to at least point out, because I think they have broad general importance. And those are the Germans who were marched by force, the German civilians who were marched by force into Buchenwald to look at the table of atrocities. And so, first of all, just why they were victims. I mean, this was immediately following the so-called liberation of the camp, right, by the Allies. And what happened was that Billy Wilder, the American film director, was brought in to make a propaganda movie. And in the movie, which is available, people can look, you know, at it on online various sources, when the German people marched into the camp, they were smiling and, you know, seemingly a relaxed group. And then when they came back, they were in shock and horror and self-hatred. And there's a great kind of review of all of these points in a film that's on the internet called Buchenwald, A Dum Dum Explanation of Evil, I think it is. I probably have the title wrong. But if you just type in, you know, Buchenwald, Dum Dum Evil, I'm sure it'll pop up. And this is a documentary film which has captions from Wilder's movie. And the reason I think this is really important is that the table, which contains the atrocities of the shrunken heads, the human lampshades, the cut out tattoos from the skin. I think those are the major, or the human pelvis ashtray. These are all fake. Right? The C.D. Jackson from the cycle is involved in all of the propaganda with Time Life. So he's the one who's actually explaining these things to the Germans, and who actually had made a film, I think it was called Sunday People, which was before the war, and basically had scenes where he would try to capture and obviously cinematically create. He would like stimulate people. Had crowds with emotion as they would walk by the camera. So he'd already had a background in the exact technique that he was trying to create this propaganda film around, which is that the Germans were basically the very epitome of human evil. And so that's why they had these bestial ornaments on the table. Now, they were all fake, right? This shows that there was an organized propaganda campaign that Wilder was part of, certainly C.D. Jackson was part of, but it had to obviously be much broader. And the purpose of it was to affect the mind of the Germans and, by proxy, all Europeans, right? I mean, this clearly, I think, is what was the purpose of it. And so that's why, and that film, the Buchenwald, the dum-dum, explanation of evil, that film does a good job because the film's name is Buchenwald, A Dum-Dum Portrayal of Evil, just to be exact. So that film does a really good job, and we've talked about it in other shows, of showing that the items on the table are obviously fake. And I'll just, sorry to be long-winded, but I'll just conclude by saying they were actually put into motion. Where did the Germans come up with the idea of shrunken heads and tattoos and all this? They come from this guy Fassenberger, and he is, I think, one of the most important parts of the power of the Holocaust, which you can see from the film is basically being presented in a propaganda fashion. I mean, they've got Billy Wilder, the film director, creating the emotional tension, the drama. You've got all of these special effects. These are fakes. I mean, the thing could just be a Steven Spielberg movie from the perspective of reality. It's just an absolutely fake thing. But this was part of what they called denazification, which was basically just making the Germans, so guilty that they couldn't really resist what was going to be kind of a political dictatorship that would be installed. So this is why it's the documentary, which I hope everyone watches. It goes into this Fassenberger, his veracity, which is zero. I mean, the guy is an absolute liar. They catch him 100 times. He's he's a German soldier, and he said, I never meant to shoot anyone. I would find blanks so that I couldn't hurt anyone if I shot. And he actually has he trips himself up. He names people that weren't in the camp. He just does everything he can to try to basically not be executed by the Allies. He was caught as a prisoner. And so he gives them what they want. He gives them all of these really horrific fantasies about what goes on in the camp. And so there's just so demonstrably fake. I just wanted to show it, give an example. I mean, one, he says, they would find a manure pile, have prisoners dig a hole in it, force them to jump down. Other prisoners would be forced to pile them up with more manure. And then these prisoners would then be forced to do exercises in calisthenics to smother the ones buried in the manure pile. Now, there were like hundreds of people who wrote documentary accounts of what went on in the camps. Zero. No one had ever seen anything like this, which, let's face it, it's just too preposterous, right, for even serious consideration. But this was in the same genre of the, of the shrunken heads, of the human skin lampshade, of the bestial ornamentation of the Germans that the propaganda device, you know, that the Allies were creating was going to tar them with. You know, this is all stuff we actually found here. And so then in the Nuremberg trial, they actually brought this stuff forward. It was part of the really powerful narrative of, like, the Germans are evil. It was also in the same genre as the Ewan Cameron's testimony regarding the Germans as just basically a psychologically deranged race, right, that would be better off if they were exterminated. Of course, this is the same guy who was doing the MKUltra, you know, psychic driving and actual Dr. Mengele type experiments. So, you know, the veracity here is not too high. But in any case, this Fassenberger was basically another kind of, you know, like underlying the bestial nature of the Germans. And so they were going to bring him on, and then they decided not to. And I am absolutely positive, Tim, that they realized they couldn't bring him on because the stories that were in documentation were contradictory, like where Fassenberger was captured, for one. Some of the people that he had in his testimony named in the camp didn't exist in the camp, or some he claimed were dead, were alive. And they knew, if they actually brought him on for any kind of testimony, that this absolute centerpiece of the Holocaust narrative, the propaganda, you know, showing that the Germans had the moral capacity and psychological capacity to actually, you know, be slaughtering millions of people inside these camps, that it would just collapse. So they didn't bring him on. There was just an amazing moment, and it's actually captured in that film, the Buchenwald, the A Dum-Dum Portrayal of Evil. They actually have the testimony, they actually have the transcripts, and that guy does a fabulous job of research. And he reads the transcripts, and you can just see that, look, they couldn't bring this guy on. If they did the whole idea of the shrunken heads and where the idea came from for the shrunken heads, any kind of, and bear in mind, they have the whole thing wired. His defense lawyer, the judge, the control over the courtroom, they have 100%. They could get any kind of testimony they wanted, but they knew there was no testimony they could get out of Fassenberger that would actually do anything except explode this crazed propaganda technique that was being in place. So when you see the film that Billy Wilder created of the Germans leaving after viewing the table and having C.D. Jackson explain to them that this, you know, is why they are bad people, these faces should pay attention to them. I think most of the faces are basically created through Wilder's, you know, cinematic technique. He was probably had a few shills in there, the ones who are explosively crying and things, because the stuff on the table, I think, honestly, to a clear-minded person just coming up, are probably too weird and fake for anyone to take seriously. However, it is possible that some people, you know, they were so emotional. Imagine this was just at the end of the war. Your town had just been taken over by the Allies. You'd probably seen every imaginable kind of you know, destruction and violence. Some people probably did, you know, may have had like these kinds of reactions. But regardless, the table was fake. It was done to create this mental control over Europeans, both, I think, not in fact, but I don't think this was particularly important, but in the cinema. You see, this is why it was so important, is to create this cinematic, pixelated reality that Wilder would enhance and create and modify, so that this could then be used against anyone who would stand up to the New World Order political structure that was going to use the Holocaust as basically a centerpiece against not only, I mean, think about how broad it is, because it isn't just these laws against the Holocaust analysis, but it is how anti-Semitism is used as an intellectual bulwark against any kind of thinking that would lead to the idea that maybe there is an undemocratic aspect to Jewish financial and political control.
Yeah, immunizes Jews or Jewish organizations from any criticism, because you immediately accuse anti-Semitism, then, you know, maybe bringing on another Holocaust if you engage in any criticism. It's Holocaust, it's sort of an ethnic folklore. And it's also important for, as you alluded to, the neoliberal global order today, because preventing the Holocaust is the, you know, is the appeal we hear often to justify, you know, the next war or another Hitler, you know, support for Israel. And I think cited in so many things about justifying U.S. military action. You know, you can't have another Holocaust. That's why, you know, serious people like Gamar Rudolph, David Irving, who was a sort of a celebrated historian until he started vocalizing his doubts regarding the Holocaust narrative, which his views have changed over the years, which one would expect, and you don't even necessarily have to agree with his conclusions, but you should defend his right to express them. He shouldn't have his bookshops shouldn't be burned down, and nor should his house be attacked, nor should he be put in prison for it. But the reality is, since the 1970s, the Holocaust narrative, at least official court historians or received historians that promote the official view, they've had to change the narrative itself. So there's revision, and with it is revisionism inside the Holocaust narrative. We once, you know, heard stories of Buchenwald, Dachau, as being death camps, and that they've had to change that now. It's I think it was Dachau where they had the fake gas chamber that they toured members of Congress went through. They set that up. That was faked. And now, so pretty much all the photographs we have of the Holocaust are from the Western camps, which now weren't really, these were typhus victims or conditions in the camp. Hunger, disease, malnutrition, conditions that were previously existed all throughout Germany at that stage of the war, it's interesting. I think it wasn't until the 80s that they started passing these denial laws. Of course, this coincided with the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the opening up of Eastern European archives. It forced sort of this revision of the narrative by academic historians of these events. I think Auschwitz had a death toll one time, was reported 4 million, and they've revised it under a million now. That's a grim number. It's bad. But you can't knock off 3 million and still keep the 6 million number. it gets to the point where you say, you know, what's going on here? What's interesting is... I think it was the David Irving. David Irving, I think, got in trouble when he went to he involved himself in the Ernst Zundel trial and spoke on his behalf and voiced. I think that was his first public expression of his skepticism towards the Holocaust, denying that Hitler gave an order, which there is no evidence of. But there is no existence of an order. But then he started doubting the whole 6 million and the gassing thing, which got him in trouble. But I believe it was in the Zundel trial where Robert Faresheim was able to cross-examine Raoul Hilberg, who was the great Holocaust historian. I think he wrote the book Destruction of the European Jewry back in the 60s.
Yeah.
It was his book. In 1961, he published The Destruction of European Jews. In this book, Hilberg presents the destruction of European Jews as a vast undertaking personally supervised by Hitler, who he says gave two orders to this effect. Then he continued, various German administrative agencies, especially in the police and military, acted in conformity with these orders, duly coordinating their efforts to prepare, organize, and control and carry out the vast criminal enterprise. So that was his position in 1961. But I think it was under I think when he was being questioned by Faresheim, he admitted, as here that he said, yeah, this is, Hilberg summarized his new thesis before an audience in nearly 2,700 at Avery Fisher Hall in New York City. The entire German policy for the physical destruction of Jews was to be explained by mind reading. This is Farrison writing. No document attesting to this criminal policy could be found. Now, this contradicts his 1961 assertion, because no such document existed. For several years, the entire German bureaucratic machinery operated through a kind of telepathy, as Hilberg put it. But what began in 1941 was a process of destruction, not planned in advance, not organized centrally by any agency. There was no blueprint, and there was no budget for the destructive measures. These measures were taken step by step, one step at a time. This came about not so much as a plan being carried out, but an incredible meeting of the minds, a consensus, mind reading by a far-flung bureaucracy. Let us note again, final words, an incredible meeting, a consensus, mind reading of a far-flung bureaucracy. So, that's a contradiction.
It's a delusion. It actually is mirrored by Farrison's interview with Otto Frank about the Diary of Anne Frank. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever seen that analysis, but that's just hilarious. Where he asks, because he drills down into how it'd be possible. If you ever see photographs of the Anne Frank house, there's like 200 windows staring right into it. I mean, it's not like hidden in some woods or something. It's right in the middle of an apartment complex.
Yeah.
And it's visible to just hundreds of people. And there is no way you could possibly stay there for 2 years without being noticed. It's impossible, let alone the absurd, like Farrison points out, they have a vacuum cleaner that they use every noon. I mean, there's just no way that this thing was working as a hiding place. And so when he drilled down to Otto Frank, and Frank agreed for some reason to let him interview him. And after a while, Frank just goes, well, you're right. I agree completely with you. You're 100% right. Scientifically, you're right. But it's like a miracle. I mean, that's literally what Frank's position was, is that it was a miracle that they could be there for 2 years without being detected. And you see, the thing is, it's like, it's just so, like so many things within the Holocaust historical narrative, the data. There's no doubt that the Frank family was there at that location from time to time. I mean, in fact, it was Otto Frank's office before the war. So he knew about it, and the family was there. The question is the version we have has a propaganda power. Has the story been constructed and falsified to have this psychological power? This is the question. It's not the question of like, were the Franks ever there? These questions are the ones that they would like to have the debate around. But the question is all the internal contradictions within Anne Frank's diary, all of the physical impossibilities of how they could have possibly been hidden, all of the problems with the actual text itself, who writes it and when. These all lead to the idea of something that is not static. It's in motion. It's being manipulated and adjusted. And whether or not Anne kept a record of her experience during the war, which couldn't have been a great one, wasn't great for anybody in this area, that isn't really the question. The question is has it been morphed into a propaganda form? It's like you get to the camps. And here's the thing you could see that was going on with Eisenhower's participation with Billy Wilder and C.D. Jackson in this whole fraud they were perpetrating in Buchenwald, is what they were trying to do was to create the impression that the condition of the camps, now that they were able to present after the destruction of Germany, after the apparatus of civilization had been severed, that condition of the camp was the camp. This was basically, when you see all these bodies piling up like cordwood and everyone is starved and it's just this horrendous world. This was the camps that the Germans ran, and it was done because they hated Jews. These are the facts that they're trying to insert into history. But there is no way that this is reality, because the camps were visited hundreds of times during the war by the Red Cross. Mm-hmm. There's documentation about all of these camps during this period. In no instance is it, you know, where they have like bulldozers piling bodies up, or, you know, crematoriums with like hundreds of thousands of people being evaporated. The condition that they want the public to have, it's the same thing. It's like basically a Billy Wilder movie. The condition that they found the camps in when they were there, with like the smell of the dead bodies and things, these were created after the collapse of Germany. This is the truth about the camps, is that, yeah, they were absolutely horrific when the Allies came, but they were not like that 6 months earlier. They were not like that during the war. There isn't any documentation whatsoever, none that I've ever been able to find, of any of the camps on the Western side that had any kind of a program which could be seen as, you know, generated from just an evil place in the heart, right? They just, where is the evidence of this? And yet, when Eisenhower, if you notice, it's interesting, when Eisenhower came to Buchenwald, he says, we have to go out and we have to bring in the media. He says, because I want all of this to be recorded so that in the future, if anyone tries to deny the Holocaust, this is what Eisenhower said. This was like right after he showed up at Buchenwald, within 24 hours. He said, if anyone tries to ever deny this in the future, I want there to be these film records to show them what it was like. So in other words, Eisenhower has already done the bait and switch. He's already taken the existence of how the camps are at the moment, and he's trying to now put this into the minds of people as what the camps were during the war. So it's pretty clever. And if you have complete control over the media, and the public is not ever permitted to do any analysis of the thing because of, you know, various forces of intimidation and now even laws, you can pull it off. But it isn't the truth. I mean, the truth is, if you want to find out what the camps are, you can't be looking at the camps after Germany collapsed.
You have to go April and May 1945. You have to look at what were they in 1943 and 42.
Go back and see what they were like. Read the Red Cross reports. Look at the photographic documentation of like Auschwitz during, you know, like 1941, 42, 43. I've looked at this stuff. I can't find anything that would suggest that there was some kind of evil afoot. Yeah, I mean, like, you can say the concentration camps are evil in and of themselves. I probably wouldn't argue that. But the idea that these are the machine of the final solution for the Jews, really? Where's that? Where is the evidence?
Well, Auschwitz itself was an industrial concern, making, you know, synthetic fuel, rubber. It was actually IBM and IG Farben were in that camp. IG Farben, of course, owned by the Warburg family, the Jewish banking family. But yeah, and there's no if you look at it, there's a lot of Allied reconnaissance aircraft photographs taken during the war. Flying over Auschwitz, and there's no evidence of mass crematoriums going on, you'd see, nor are there records within the German. I mean, the amount of energy and resources it will take to run a killing machine, something with the alleged, you know, enormity of the final solution, that you could have been a far-flung bureaucracy reading each other's minds. There'd be paper trails, there'd be requisition forms for fuel, and these things do not exist. Not to mention the fact that there simply weren't enough. How long it takes to cremate a body?
It's just like the shrunken heads.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just preposterous. They were able, because they controlled the media, they were able to put forward any idea that they felt that would be effective at mind control. And so this is where the idea of the crematory. One thing that was interesting that I didn't know, that I watched the Buchenwald Dum Dum, you know, example of evil, that they said, they claimed that they had pictures of Buchenwald and they had crematoriums. They had about maybe 10 ovens, you know, that are used, because obviously there's going to be deaths, and they have typhus epidemics and things, and old people die of old age. And remember, it's a war that's going on, so there's people who are shot and whatnot are brought to these places. Anyway, so they have these places where they get rid of the bodies, and they need to do this for hygiene. Anyway, they say that the U.S. propaganda movie claimed that the people who made the ovens made baking ovens for bread, but then they were forced into this line of work during the war. And they create this really, you know, you can think about how nauseating that concept is. You know, an oven for bread, now it's a final solution crematorium device. But the fact is, it's completely untrue. The company never made ovens for bread. They made crematorium ovens and some other but they threw that concept in for psychological purposes. See, this is what they went through. They when they got Fassenberger, this crazy loon they found wandering around the countryside in Germany, and he came up with all these cock and bull stories about Buchenwald. This you know, they go, well, wait a second, you know, we can actually build on these rumors, and we will create these things, you know, we can actually go out, we can find them, and we can start. And so this was, you know, a longstanding process that, you know, in which they were able to go out and get the artifacts and then create the stories, you know, the stories of the camps, the death camps. And they would then have in the Buchenwald video, the guy had a really interesting point. He had a picture of a couple American GIs, and they're standing next to a bunch of bodies that are lying there at the Buchenwald. And he said, you know, imagine like it's 20 years later, and these GIs are back home, and someone questions, you know, like the Holocaust narrative. Imagine how that GI would have lit into him and says, oh no, I was there. I saw the bodies, you know. But the fact is, he's being manipulated just like by everyone else. I mean, he's part of the Billy Wilder movie. You see, this is the thing. The whole reality of the camps immediately after the collapse of Germany, when the Allies came in and could, you know, create, you know, shrunken heads tables and stuff, it's all just being arranged for propaganda purposes. Now, there is an objective reality. There's no question. And obviously there was, you know, I mean, like, you don't want to get into Holocaust denial, do you? You know, but the fact is, it's irrelevant because there is propaganda being created. This is just without a doubt. And since propaganda is being created, citizens just have to, you know, we have to just kick it all out. We can't let a single one of these concepts reside in our mind without some attempt to analyze the veracity of the data in back of it, you know?
Yeah.
Because the table is fake, Billy Wilder's film is fake, and then from that moment on, all of the poor Europeans that had to go through by the table, they are just representing the Europeans now that have to go by the table of the media that's set for us every single day with Steven Spielberg movies and all of the documentation that they have, where we are exactly like they are. We are just being led in front of the table of the atrocities for the purpose of, you know, as to just make you impotent intellectually because you're so guilt-ridden that you can't resist any kind of, you know, Brave New World takeover.
What's interesting is that just some of these denials, if they simply didn't prosecute it, there wouldn't be much publicity. You had this case of Ursula Haverbeck, an 89-year-old grandmother.
Yeah.
Serving 2 years in prison for expressing her critique of the narrative, her criticism of it. I mean, really? An 89-year-old grandmother you can put in jail? Are you that afraid? There was a while back, I guess the Catholic priest, he's a member of SSPX, Richard Williamson, who was asked in an interview, like someone asked him a question, and he responded to it. And since the interview was recorded in Germany, and it was, I think, aired on Swedish television, and then he was fined and went back and he was fined and all this. What happened was, since it was aired on German television, since he was asked a question in Germany and aired on Swedish television, Germany reserved the right to prosecute him. And that was the standard with that was set with Ernst Zundel. He had a Zundel site. It was his website, and it wasn't in Germany. I think it was in Canada. And Germany prosecuted him for his site that came out of Canada. And so Germany reserves the right to prosecute anyone throughout the world.
Saying that they have, in other words, the crime is a world jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And that the Germans are saying that if you express this analysis in the United States, we can
prosecute you.
Well, gee, that doesn't really help, push along the Socratic method, very much. Don't you think, Tim? I mean, that's a little dictatorial and, what are they afraid of?
Yeah. First of all, just with the case of Richard or Williamson, Father Williamson, well, he's asked a question. So now, right. If someone asks you a question, you can't answer them honestly, you'll be prosecuted.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, it's absurd. It's and then you have this atrocity of Ernst Zundel being dragged out of the United States, being raided on his house. This guy had never committed a crime in his life, a violent act. By the way, when it comes to Ernst Zundel, they found some pretext with one of his application forms for immigration weren't in order. So that became a pretext for expelling him and extraditing him back to Germany. Because remember, he had emigrated to Canada and escaped Canada because Canada's Human Rights Commission doesn't acknowledge free speech. But in this case, in the case of Ernst Zundel, U.S. government can enforce its immigration laws. In bad faith, of course. It's obviously someone was pulling the strings. It was in bad faith. And the fact that they're, I guess chutzpah is the word, I guess I want to use here.
Yes, for a term.
There's no shame. I was like, this old man who's, I don't care if you disagree with him and his newsletter, his website, for Pete's sake. I mean, come on. You arrest him and put him in final years of his life, you put him in solitary confinement, I think, for 5 years.
Well, I just think when this goes on, it just shows that they really are afraid of any kind of thinking. And they certainly don't want any kind of a fad of thinking about this to emerge where people are, it becomes like more commonplace. And that's why we really have to attempt to create that. I think the place to start in my mind is just with Billy Wilder's film.
Yeah.
It's ground zero of the Holocaust narrative. We ought to like actually go in and say, okay, where are the shrunken heads? Where is the lampshade? I mean, didn't just throw these things in a trash can. Where are they? We want to do DNA testing. We want to look at the tattoos of the skin to see if they came from the university that was 10 miles away that had a collection of these kinds of tattoos on human skin. We want to basically go, we want to compare what Nuremberg trial lawyers claim Fassenberger was saying versus Fassenberger's own affidavit the day he was caught, because there is a slight problem. The problem is that the Nuremberg trial lawyers were saying that, yeah, Fassenberger was identifying these items as at the time of the liberation of the camp. Oops, this is one of the reasons why they couldn't bring him on the stand, because actually it had happened like they'd captured him 6 months ago.
Oh, yeah. So, yes. And they
300 miles from Brooklyn. I mean, the guy was just a complete lunatic. And so they knew they couldn't bring Fassenberger on the stand. If they did, man, this is why they made that decision. That even though they actually had called him, they brought him there. They were going to have him, and it was over the weekend. The case closed down on Friday. It was going to open back up on Monday. He's going to be the first witness. And over the weekend, they started going over this. And they go, wait a second. This could just be a complete disaster. And they pulled the plug. So what I'm thinking is, you know what? Let's just do our own interrogation of Fassenberger, who's long dead. We can do it just by making the public, revelation of the contradictions and absurdities and outright obvious propaganda techniques that went into the table. They claimed that Fassenberger had identified these things and that he knew that they had come because of these atrocities, just like the exercise class on top of the the poor buried underneath.
Well, there's the kind of like a running. It's almost like someone told me it's almost like a creative writing class, where these so much of the Holocaust is it's oral history, meaning there's no documentary or forensic evidence to back it up. You have stories, horror stories that people tell, and they're going to embellish and up the ante to make the stories more fantastic as years go by. And if you were just to take it out of the context of the Holocaust and listen to someone's story, yes, so do you believe this? Is this, you know, is it really feasible that they'd put, what was that one story where they put a guy in a cage with a bear and an eagle or something?
Yeah, because they're just, these are ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, they aren't really even effective torture. And then when you have no documentation, it's like Fassenberger's, the exterminate class, right? Where you have groups of prisoners doing calisthenics on top of Germans or on top of people buried underneath the crap. There would have been other people talking about this. It wouldn't just be a one-off. So, you know, it's just ridiculous.
It's like the stories you hear about Mengele, right? I mean, there's no evidence for it. These are just oral history. These are stories.
Oral history. When you have this ethnic, advantage, and that's something that the guy, whoever put together the Buchenwald, A Dumb, Dumb Portrayal of Evil, he actually had the guts to do it. He gets out there and he goes, why would Wilder do this? And he goes, well, you got to consider the fact that he's Jewish.
You might, yes.
and this is like an evolutionary kind of ethnic advantage moment where, he can basically create domination over another ethnic group.
Well, these are myths. And this is the same thing that Andrew Joyce writes about the myth of the pogroms in Russia, how they were wildly exaggerated. The reasons for the Jews leaving wasn't oppression. They weren't running away from Cossacks. For the most part, they were seeking better living conditions in the West, particularly in the United States. But the stories, the horror stories, were played a key role in the United States allowing them to come in. At the same time, they also internalized these myths.
And the thing is, the group that I think has really been damaged by the Holocaust narrative, by the propaganda, are Jews. Think of I've actually talked to Jews who were traumatized by the lampshade. Now the trauma that the Jews have, right, from the propaganda is also to the advantage of the oligarchs.
Yeah.
Because now the Jews as a group won't criticize any of the moral behavior of the oligarchs. They'll go, well, gee whiz, I mean, we're just kind of trying to fight back a little bit, aren't we? Against all of the oppression we face. It's like, When I was bringing up to this guy who is in show business, and I go, you have like a lot of blood on your hands there, buddy, because the show business has brought about so many deaths. I mean, look at rap music, and look who owns all that, and it's like pretty bloody. And his response was, he goes, well, he says, we've been kicked out of every country we've ever wanted to get into, and so in other words, in his Jewish guy, and in his mind, the oppression narrative equaled no moral, currency for how blacks have been crushed by the rap music culture that they have basically promoted, right? That the fact that they own all of the large music rep companies that are putting out this filth that is obvious, that's just wiping out the African American culture. There's no moral issue here. We've been kicked out of all these countries.
There's no introspection.
Because it's just this automatic thing. We're just trying to fight back. We've been wrong so many thousands of times. And of course, if you pry into that, you can only go for two sentences without the Holocaust popping up.
Mm-hmm.
The lampshade comes right back up. So that's why let's return to the table. Let's get back to the table. Let's, instead of the Billy Wilder version, let's have a more Socratic logic reason version of the film where we go, really, Negroid features on a shrunken skull with hair that is maybe like six inches long in a camp where everyone has heads shorn. And I don't see a single a dark skinned person. How did this shrunken head get here? Let's start there and try to work backwards, because if we do that, then everything comes off the table. Everything just comes right off the table. It's just obvious. There's nothing on the table that's real. It's 100%. And because, you know, Tim, because every single thing on that table is fake, because I mean, a pelvis isn't a real ashtray. There's too many holes in it. It won't hold a cigarette. The shrunken heads can't. They don't even know how to make shrunken heads.
Well, I mean, during the war, Life magazine on its cover had a pretty girl writing a letter to her boyfriend as she stared adoringly at a Japanese skull that her boyfriend sent her. So, beautiful. I mean, I think FDR himself received a Japanese skull from.
Yeah, that's, they're the well, and of course, Time Life, I mean, they're skull and bones. I mean, yeah. they're just their part and parcel. But anyway, I think you get to the table and you realize the whole thing is just a propaganda device. And then watch Wilder's film. Then watch the Europeans come back with the shame and the guilt and the intimidation, right? Watch the film closely. You can see what Wilder does. When they come to the camps, they're all proud. They're walking tall. They're smiling. They're happy. You know, it looks like, hey, things are finally picking up. And then you have C.D. Jackson, of all the humans on the planet, there with the table. And he's explaining to them, and browbeating them about, here, this is what it is. This is how evil you are. And now Wilder captures this dramatic change, right? Now you get to see how crushed the Europeans are after they've been subjected to the propaganda. Man, this was like the foreshadowing of like the next 100 years, because what you saw was basically how our media was going to react. When you get to, just name the film, that covers World War II, the Germans are always portrayed as bestial.
Mm-hmm.
They're never humans. They're always, morally... deranged individuals, psychopaths. They're a race that deserves no human compassion. But the problem is that it basically, that perspective then becomes the way that Gentiles in general are looked at and treated and have to deal with this structure, because anti-Semitism has at its core the powerful mainspring of the Holocaust.
Yeah, the guilt, and so from the guilt. Yeah,
all Gentiles, you're all guilty. So, okay, so look, the portrayal of the camps that gets into the films is the portrayal of the last 2 days of the camp's existence. Let's go back and look at try to figure out what the camps were like during the war. There's evidence. We can actually work to this idea. We're not being deniers of anything. We just want to work back and see what the camps really were before the Allied bombing, right, which destroyed all of the food, basically transportation, and the deliberate efforts by the Allies to create starvation and chaos and destruction before that had that started to affect the camps. So that then when the Allies came and took pictures of it, they're looking. I mean, they could get gruesome pictures just as with as many bodies inside of Dresden and Hamburg.
Yeah, but they didn't show those to the American people. Yeah.
What would that mean? So the way the camps are portrayed is propaganda. The stuff on the table to create the Germans as bestial is just absolute propaganda. And it's just, we can work through this stuff analytically and hopefully come to a place where we're not going to be so damaged by this, this propaganda, this crap.
There's a article, this is written by Mark Weber, who is the head of the Institute for Historical Review. And he writes, expressions of disbelief about the Holocaust are swiftly and fiercely punished. Holocaust blasphemy is routinely treated as more offensive than verbal assaults against the well-established religious beliefs and sensibilities of many millions in Europe and around the world. In short, Jewish feelings and sensibilities are regarded as more important than those of non-Jews. In our society, the Holocaust is held up as an icon of virtually religious stature. Jewish leaders, supported by many non-Jewish political figures and much of the media, insist on everyone's dogmatic affirmation of this totem, one that is used to further Jewish Zionist interests. Tony Jute, a Jewish scholar who serves as director of the Remarque Institute at New York University, has written, "The Shoah is frequently exploited in America and Israel to deflect and forbid any criticism of Israel. Indeed, the Holocaust of Europe's Jews is nowadays exploited thrice over. It gives American Jews in a particular a unique retrospective victim identity. It allows Israel to trump any other nation's sufferings and justify its own excesses with the claim that the Jewish catastrophe was unique and incomparable, and in contradiction to the first two, it is adduced as an all-purpose metaphor for evil anywhere, everywhere and always, and taught to school children all over America and Europe without any reference to context or cause. This modern instrumentalization of the Holocaust for political advantage is ethically disreputable and politically imprudent. Norman Finkelstein, a Jewish scholar who teaches at or taught, this is, I think he's been since lost that post, at DePaul University in Chicago, writes in his best-selling book, The Holocaust Industry, that invoking the Holocaust is a ploy to delegitimize all criticism of Jews. He adds, by conferring total blamelessness on the Jews, the Holocaust dogma immunizes Israel and American Jewry from legitimate censure. Organized American Jewry has exploited the Nazi Holocaust to deflect criticism of Israel's and its own morally indefensible policies. The Holocaust Remembrance Campaign reflects an arrogant view of Jews as a special and superior people. Abraham Foxman, head of the Anti-Defamation League, one of the most influential Zionist groups, has declared the Holocaust is something different. It is a singular event. It's not simply one example of a genocide, but a near successful attempt on the life of God's chosen children and thus on God himself. It's an event that is the antithesis of creation as recorded in the Bible, and like its direct opposite, which is relived weekly with the Sabbath and yearly with the Torah, it must be remembered from generation to generation. I mean, that's...
That guy is completely... I mean, I know he is. He is as... I don't know if he's sincere or if he's just talking his book. I mean, you know, he makes a lot of political power out of that concept. They get to intimidate a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he actually believes it. Maybe he does, but you know.
You're talking about Norman Finkelstein?
Yeah, I mean, okay. No. Not Finkelstein, the guy who Foxman.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, I don't know if Foxman is sincere. It might just be, you know, because it is completely insane. So, that you know, one hopes that he's just trying to lie in order to get political advantage. But yeah. Maybe he's nuts. Look, if he is, if he actually believes that.
You know, he's a baptized Catholic.
He would. What's that?
He's a baptized Catholic.
Foxman?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
He was, what happened during World War II, he was adopted by a Catholic family. His family gave him up. He was taken in by a Jewish family who adopted him. And after the war, they came back and sued and got him back. Yeah, so no good deed goes unpunished, right?
Well, anyway, okay, I don't know his background. I just know that. my point is that whatever it is, that's an interesting background. My point is this, that he would benefit from the Holocaust analysis that we're suggesting mm-hmm. here. Forget Holocaust denial. That already, you know, has pejorative and
it shuts down thought.
Look, let's do some Holocaust analysis. Let's go back to the table. Let's go back to ground zero. Let's go back to the table, see what's on the table, what's real, what isn't. Let's go back to Wilder's film. Let's look at that. Is this being deliberately created, or are these real emotions? Are we looking at a like a Spielberg fictional movie, right? Or that is being created for propaganda? Or is there anything historical about this? And then, for heaven's sakes, let's stop looking at the video of the last 7 days of the camp's existence after Germany was destroyed. Let's try to go back and see what they were during the war. Because that's really where we're going to find the truth about the German relationship to the Jews. Because like you say, when you look for, you know, like a lot of people, you know, first of all, you have the WANSI documents, which
January, February 1942 meeting.
Yeah, the final solution is mentioned. But you know what the final solution it mentioned was? It mentioned that we'd move all the Jews to Madagascar.
Yeah, this is the issue of translation here. They play games with that too.
But of course, you have 1,000 problems with the documents. The provenance of it is just horrible. So, and some of there's internal problems in terms of whether or not it's like legitimately.
You mentioned the guy was the guy Farsenberg or.
Yeah, the lawyer, Jewish lawyer guy who found it, supposedly.
Yeah, there are a countless number of Germans willing to give false testimony and provide documents. That's what got David Irving in trouble, because he proved a lot of these documents were contradictory or false or the testimonies didn't hold up because they could prove these people weren't there when they said they were.
Yeah, basically, Fassbender, he was like drawing people out of the thin air, saying they were none of them were there. He was saying that some of the guys were dead that were still alive.
Well, even today, so, like, you know, the famous Hossbach Memorandum in 1937, which was used to prove Germany's aggressive intent, has now been sort of debunked. It's questioned now. And same with the table talks, which are based on a testimony. Hitler's infamous table talks now are now. You really have to doubt the veracity of these things or how they've been manipulated. You know, and you know, for purposes for political purposes after the war, you just can't take them at face value. And it's an unfortunate reality, but it's a reality.
Right.
But this is that image we have, just like the whole image of that era, the demonization and these things. People are so heavily invested in it that it's very hard to get them to disabuse themselves of, or just to question it. I'm just asking you just to question it. You know, I'm not saying I know exactly what happened. I'm simply saying that some of these stories simply don't have the evidence to back it up. If the Final Solution was as huge and as industrial as it was claimed, there'll be, just common sense tells you, there'd be bodies, mass graves, there'll be area photographs of things going on, you know, records of requisition for fuel. Again, the whole idea that Germany would undertake this thing in the midst of a war, when it was fighting a two-front war and its resources were taxed to the hilt, that it would, you know, we hear that, you know, Germany was so ideologically driven to kill the Jews that it took away from the war effort. You know, rail stock and these things. No, it makes sense if the labor is then being used for slave labor. And I would have to admit, probably in some cases, mistreated. That's just the nature of things, you know. But
100% it's slave labor, but it wasn't like it's not a program against the Jews. They were just rounding up everybody they get their hands on.
Yeah.
To try to make some more bombs so that they wouldn't go out of existence.
And it doesn't distinguish Germany from our allies, you know, the Soviets, who used slave labor.
To try to find some kind of moral high ground in World War II is very, very difficult because they were all just absolutely, it was total war, Tim.
And then you have the camp. I mean, the prisoner of war camps were, I think there was like a 98 survival rate from the Allies at the hands of the Germans, who did abide by the Red Cross.
Well, I didn't really see many Germans come out of Eisenhower's camp.
That's not talked about. You're right.
Gosh darn it. I mean, I don't quite understand that because...
That's one of the ironies of this war, the Rhine-Meadow camps and the Morgenthau. Yeah. I mean, we do have an order in the Morgenthau plan. We do have a signed order.
Right. We actually have an order here to show, like, in terms of genocide. But so there it is. I mean, The Holocaust doesn't, it's just so, there. You need more analysis of the thing. It shouldn't really have any propaganda power because it is just not well enough documented.
Why do we need analysis when we have Schindler's List?
Well, you're right. I mean, how about Raiders of the Lost Ark? I mean, remember there, God's stuff, he turned the Germans into like molten wax images. After
the Nazis, apparently in 1936, the Nazis occupied Egypt.
Yeah, and they stole the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, that would be something, you know, that you'd need to have if you were going to go to work, because it'd be handy. So, you know, I mean, it's just, these are ludicrous, but you see, they all affect the mind. You know, they're not without effect, and they're not, in fact, created except for the idea of having control.
Yeah.
I mean, that they are kind of an ethnic warfare component, you know, because it basically... You know, all the Germans basically represent, you know, Europeans, and they are as totally evil. And the Ark of the Covenant is obviously here. If you're on the right side of that, God will wipe out your enemies. So, you know, these are folkloric dividing lines, but they're not serious analysis, and we shouldn't let this stuff into our mind.
Well, people shouldn't be imprisoned and fined for.
No. Of course not. This is just
analyzing it. Yeah.
If they thought they could analyze, I mean, instead of all of these, what do they call them? The Museum of Tolerance.
Oh yes, the Simon Wiesenthal.
Museum of Analysis.
Well, that's actually we talked about these mandatory classes. Apparently, that's what got this principal in trouble down in Florida. Is he merely stated that this is a controversial topic. He wasn't even his own views. He gets hounded from his job. But if these classes were to involve debate, open debate and analysis of it, then I'd invite it. I'd say, okay, But they're not. These are indoctrination things.
Well, that's the whole point. Yeah. But if they would have classes like that, then you see.
But what if there's some one kid in there goes, "Hey, wait a second. What about?"
Yeah, where's Fassenberger? What happened to Fassenberger? Why isn't he brought? Can we want to hear what he had to say? If he just asked the question, the whole thing.
Well, the thing is, what they'll do is they'll introduce like third graders to this stuff and traumatize them with these stories. And the whole point of Andrew Joyce, I think it was Andrew Joyce, wrote an article that said he talked about one of these classes. And he apparently imagined a student, a precocious student asking uncomfortable questions to the teacher during one of these classes. And he says, of course, this is fantasy. No fourth grader is going to do this, which is the point. You know,
of course they will be. Yeah. You know, we either are thinking or we believe, and belief is always, you know, to some extent constructed by intimidation. And so we have to just stop the belief because there's just nothing to back it up. You can actually see, I mean, in the withdrawal of Fappenberger and even in the fact that you have to have, like Eisenhower saying, you know, we got to get the media here to take pictures of what the camps are like now to put those images into the minds of the public. Otherwise, they could be doubting the Holocaust in the years to come. They were always planning to use the Holocaust as a mind control technique. In my opinion, this wasn't like ad hoc after the war. This was something they were thinking about all the way through because they knew that this would give them the kind of power over the European world, America, you know, and that would last.
Yeah.
And you could bring in, Israel, for example, mm-hmm. and you could wipe out the Palestinians you could get that done without any public basically protest or a whole lot of it because you had this extraordinary intellectual plunge that you could just put in to stop up thinking anytime you needed to. And so, you know, I mean, wouldn't you say, Tim, that it's like the Holocaust is the most important sort of intellectual construction that we have in the world today? I mean, it just, everything depends upon it. And so that's why I think it's such an important thing to go back and, you know, forget Holocaust denial. This is already losing, you know, the argument before, you know, you start an argument. Let's start advocating Holocaust analysis. You know, what were the camps during the war? What is the evidence for a focused, like a genocide of the Jews as opposed to how Poles were treated or Gypsies or, you know, like Russians or whatever, other captives? And then, you know, like, let's go to the table. Well, where's the shrunken heads? Where's the human lampshade? These were the original representations of what the camps were. These were the very first things that they brought to the public. The very first thing. They were brought into the Nuremberg trial, right? They thought they were so important. Okay, let's start analyzing these things. Where are the shrunken heads? Where are the lampshades? You know, who made the lampshade? This poor, you know, woman. But they have the lampshade on the table. How come there's no tattoos in the parchment if they're supposed to be tattoos, if this is what it's supposed to be? You know, the whole story just collapses. And then you get to Fappenberger, who's still waiting to be called on trial 100 years later. I mean, you know, I think that they cannot stand any kind of real scrutiny. And they were trying to keep that scrutiny from starting. But it's impossible. We can't go forward, to a better world, to use an expression, without getting this whole thing right and straight. Mm-hmm. And so we just have to do it. And we just have to just constantly beat our heads against the irrationality and say, no, let's just keep thinking about it.
And it's nice that people like, you know, Jews like Deborah Lipstadt, and Noam Chomsky will voice criticism of Holocaust denial laws as violation of free speech. But they're just two individuals. The fact of the matter is there's no Jewish organizations like the ADL or any that are really advocating free speech and also being upset that people are being imprisoned for simply their political or historical views. So it's meaningless, really. It's what they can say these things and sort of come across as being advocates of free speech, but the greater Jewish organizations are opponents of free speech. and in a,
there so. Because the Holocaust obviously it just works so well for them in every single thing that they do. I mean, I think it would be very tough for even for Israel to basically expose the Palestinians and seize all their lands if they didn't have the moral bulwark of the Holocaust.
No, yeah.
So you'd have you can see what I mean. I mean, it's just, again, the whole world is kept from thinking clearly because of the existence of this intellectual construction that just interferes with thought. So we've got to get it right. It just, we have to do it. And Tim, I think we've done it tonight.
So, okay, Joe.
Hey, buddy. Talk to you soon, huh?
Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.